A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 141. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Last Enemy. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, The Last Enemy, a BBC miniseries that came out in 2008, quite a recent show for us here on British Invaders. 5 episodes. The first one was, I suppose, feature length. That ran for 90 minutes. And then 4 subsequent episodes, each of about 60 minutes long. And quite a lot of stuff in this show for us to talk about, Ryan.
Yes, there is. It was a mix of sort of political intrigue and like a political drama type premise, along with some spy fiction mixed in and sort of spy-fi, if you like, a bit of science fiction and a sort of surveillance dystopia, futuristic surveillance technology, and some sort of dystopia, or if you like, sort of paranoia based on those types of ideas. So there's some interesting things there. It's set in a future version of London, which is much like our own, but with some very ominous types of surveillance going on and tracking of individuals that is rather intimidating and rather interesting.
Okay, and we will get into some of those changes in London as we go along. So the setup, we have a character called Stephen Ezard, who is a maths genius, and is returning to England after a long stay abroad. He's been living and working in China, and he has to come home, as we learn right at the start, for the funeral of his brother. So I suppose in certain sort of spy fiction or thriller some convention, it starts with a funeral. And of course, as we've already said, Stephen Ezard returns to find that London is quite a bit different to how he remembered it. And all these changes, which we're going to talk about as we go along, have happened. And he finds London a rather strange place. And there's lots of strangeness going on.
Yes, that's right. You have increased security. There is a system of ID cards that are often used to restrict people's movements. And you have armored police and cameras on just about every street corner. So there's this very intense version of the surveillance being used for police purposes and so on. That is very much an ever-present thing. And as Stephen Ezard is coming into this version of London that in many ways he doesn't recognize, he also realizes that he didn't know his brother quite as well as he thought he did. And there are things in his brother's life and lots of people he didn't know about, and this whole community that he is learning about.
That's right. Lots of stuff for him to discover. And as we've sort of hinted in the introduction, this is a sort of spy thriller, a conspiracy thriller. There are secrets and mysteries for Stephen to sort of unravel as the episodes unfold. There's quite a bit going on, really, as we go along.
Yes, absolutely. As with many of these sorts of spy thriller and political thriller types of shows, there is quite a large and complex cast of characters involved.
Okay, so we'll get into those cast of characters. We'll start, as we've said, with Stephen Ezard, a maths genius who we learn in the first episode has come up with a theorem, Ezard's theorem, which is mentioned by some of the people he encounters. And he's a rather sort of strange, detached figure. He does have some sort of features of obsessive compulsive disorder. He's very obsessive about hygiene and so on. And he will be clearly forced out of his comfort zone in some of the investigations he's going to have to do in London. And Stephen Ezard was played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who, of course, has since gone on to be much better known for playing Sherlock in the Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss revival of Sherlock Holmes, or sort of reimagining of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, that's right. And Stephen Ezard was also something of a recluse who had gone and settled in China, basically so he could work on the mathematical things he was working on and so forth, and be able to just do it on his own with very little influence or interaction from anyone else. So when he's coming back to London, he is very much a fish out of water, because he is forced to have much more interaction with people than he had before or than he wanted to. And he is also coming into this London that he really doesn't recognize because of all these changes. Now, another major character is Michael Ezard, who is Stephen's brother, and we see Michael Ezard through flashback. He dies at the beginning, as we have mentioned, with the funeral and so on. And he worked for an international aid organization in Afghanistan and actually died there. And he had this large circle of friends and admirers and people who really liked and appreciated his work. So when Stephen Ezard goes to Michael's funeral, you get this situation where Stephen is encountering this big group of people who knew and appreciated Michael Ezard, and, you know, it's all very new to Stephen. Michael Ezard was played by Max Beasley, who went on to be in the Survivors remake not long after this show.
And as you say, Michael Ezard got lots of friends and admirers, something that Stephen doesn't seem to have. And the other thing that Michael had was a wife, Yassim Ezard, Michael's wife, who was a doctor working with the same aid organization in Afghanistan. And Stephen Ezard meets her, and in fact will go on to start a relationship with her, which will form another part of the tangled plot as we go into it. And Yassim was played by the actress Anna Maria Marinka, who we've actually very recently seen on television, as she appeared in the episode Asylum of the Daleks in the most recent season of the new Doctor Who.
That's right, yeah. And as you say, we have lots of characters here. We had David Russell, who is this sort of mysterious rogue intelligence agent. We don't know exactly what his goals are or who he's working for or if he really is independent. But what we do know is that he clearly is very capable and rather ruthless as an agent. And he was played by Robert Carlyle, who again went on to be much better known, but in his case in Stargate Universe in the US. So David Russell was also this very interesting character who brings out a lot of tension between some of the other characters and so on.
As you say, we've got quite the cast here in this show, as you'll probably gather as we're going along.
And then we get into a number of people who are part of the government and sort of looking at things from that perspective. Eleanor Brooke, played by Eva Birtwistle, is this government minister who's charged with delivering a new information security system. And she is an old friend of Stephen's. So you get a whole set of interactions happening with Stephen from the government side through Eleanor, and then other things through other characters as well. But she is definitely sort of a focal point for some of those relationships.
And as you say, she's friendly with Stephen, but there are three other members of the government who we'll see who don't seem to be so friendly. And we often see them meeting, having apparently secret meetings and discussing conspiracies and mysteries. We have the character Patrick Nye, played by a very sort of imposing, well-known actor, David Harewood. He is a government agent of some description who in turn reports to Barbara Turney, who is, we learn later on, is actually the Prime Minister's secretary, and she was played by Geraldine James. And then finally, there's another character, George Gibbon, who was played by the actor Christopher Fulford, who we saw in the apocalyptic drama from ITV, The Last Train. And actually, I found his role in the government slightly hard to work out, Brian. I'm not sure if I missed this, but he certainly seems to be involved in the plans, but it's not quite sure which part of government he works in.
Yes, that's right. He is very high up, quite clearly, but exactly where all of these people sit is, in many cases, not clear. And there are some interesting things there because of that. But these government characters, certainly Patrick Barbara and George Gibbon, are clearly sort of pulling a lot of strings from behind the scenes. And there is some interesting things that happen there.
So why China?
That's where I work best.
Because?
It's peaceful. It's very foreign. I haven't got a clue what's going on. The world doesn't intrude. I can concentrate. I'm not distracted by the minutiae of other people's lives.
Michael told me something about your work. Studying killer bees.
Several years ago, I developed a mathematical model, the genesis of which was a statistical analysis of insect swarm in which killer bees played a component, a very, very small theoretical component.
And all this time, I had you in a beekeeper's outfit.
And I love the Michael's good stories.
So, getting into a bit more of the situation that these people are in, because the situation of this is very sort of interesting and complex. London is actually recovering from a terrorist attack, which was the Victoria bombing. And this is sort of a big incident in the recent past of this show that is sort of a focal event that moves things in the direction of greater security and so on. And what that brings us to is, and sort of the initial thing that's happening in this show in many ways, is the introduction of the TIA system, Total Information Awareness, which is a computer system that is designed to read things from all available databases and all available security camera footage and do lots of collation of this kind of data and give you basically any kind of information about anyone's whereabouts and activities and do lots of things to try to find things that are suspicious, but also to be able to get large amounts of information about individuals. And there is this security company called Ecudo that is designing this system and putting it together for the government to use and deploy.
Yes, as you say, it's the database to end all databases and the security system that will beat any other security system. And as you say, the government, and particularly in the shape of Eleanor Brooke, really want this in place. They are obviously reacting to the recent terrorist events, and Eleanor, as a friend of Stephen, I think puts him in touch with the security company, or the security company certainly contact him, because they are very keen to have Stephen Ezard, this sort of world-renowned mathematician, associated with the project as a sort of promotional figurehead. And in return, they offer to fund his mathematical research for so many years, for, you know, for his involvement and his sort of blessing on the project. So he gets involved with this TIA, this Total Information Awareness System, as you say, partly through the security company, partly through his contacts with Eleanor Brooke in the government, who's an old friend of his. And it's a way for Stephen Ezard, I suppose, to get into some of the mysteries and conspiracies surrounding security in this futuristic London.
Yes, that's right. And it also gives the government, in its more public face through Eleanor, and also you have the more secret side of the government through Patrick, Barbara, and George, but it gives that group of people in the government the opportunity to say, look, there is this very intelligent outsider who has, you know, nothing to gain, is not associated with the government directly, and so on, to say, yes, this is a great system. It won't be a problem for individuals and rights, and it will be very good for security and preventing terrorist acts and so on and so forth.
Yes, they, as you say, they want to use him as the sort of acceptable face of it and to basically dismiss some of the fears about this new system.
Of course, Stephen has the ulterior motive not only for getting funding for his own research, but also wants to use this TIA system to find out more about how his brother Michael died, and more about how Yazim, his brother's wife, is involved. And there is a young woman who Yazim was looking after in Michael's old flat, who actually died there. And Stephen is trying to use TIA to get information about these things and sort of unravel what seems to be, you know, the conspiracies around these things. And of course, the plot thickens as you learn more about these different things, and there is murder involved, there are medical mysteries and strange things happening, and of course there is espionage and things with spies involved as well.
Yes, all sorts of stuff happening, and all of it being monitored in a way by this total information awareness system, which Stephen has now got access to, although at the price being that he has to appear in public and make public statements about the system.
Yes, that's right.
So, turning to our production notes, we'll start here with the writer, a chap called Peter Berry, best known for writing TV crime dramas such as the Ruth Rendell mysteries, and he also wrote the sixth installment of Prime Suspect, the Helen Mirren crime show. And the BBC approached him to write a political thriller. And this was sort of this coincided with him thinking or considering the idea that the UK society was at the time sleepwalking towards a surveillance state. And it was so from that sort of idea about surveillance society that he started to work on this particular project.
That's right. And what he decided on as a way of examining the situation was to have a central character who was returning after a long period abroad. So all of these changes would happen and this character would come in and see everything anew and see how everything had changed. And they got Ian B. MacDonald to come on as director, who was known for Bodies and Bone Kickers, and also went on to work on the new Survivors remake from a couple years ago.
That's right. And we've got a producer, Gub Neal, with a company called Box TV. And interestingly, this was another jointly funded project. So partly funded by the BBC and then partly funded by WGBH television in Boston, America. So that's where presumably they get some of the funding for the big cast and some of the big effects that we'll go on to mention.
Yes, WGBH, of course, has been a longtime supporter of British television, and they've put a lot into that over the years. The series was shot in London and also in Romania, with places in Romania standing in for Afghanistan in parts of it, for the things with the aid organization that Michael and Yazim were with in Afghanistan, and also some sort of damaged areas of London. They were using Romania for that as well. Magnus Fiennes, yes, from the famous Fiennes acting family, wrote the music for this.
And the music's pretty good, and the title music accompanies some nice sort of graphics of the computer system logging on, and we have a computer voice that goes with that informs us that the TIA system is logging on at the start of each episode and then logs off at the end of each episode. So not bad use of graphics either side of the episodes.
It fits very much with the style of this show and the sort of recent, you know, time in which it was made. It fits that very well.
Okay, and then broadcast on the BBC in February 2008. As we've said, five episodes, with the first episode being sort of slightly longer, 90-minute running time, and then the rest of the episode, 60 minutes.
And it was shown in the US on Masterpiece Theatre on PBS later that year, later in 2008, with introductions by the actor Matthew Good.
And I gather it's fairly usual for the Masterpiece Theatre to have some sort of spoken introduction by somebody before the episodes.
Yes, they've had sort of a host doing introductions on that series for many years. And they've run a variety of things on there, often British television, but also sometimes film and sometimes things that are from other places as well.
Okay, so not something we're used to much over here now, but there's the actor Matthew Good in introducing the episodes. And that brings us to talking about the availability of the episodes. Over here in Region 2, I've been watching the Region 2 release, which has two discs, all the five episodes, a fairly basic making of documentary, not particularly a long one. It is astonishingly cheap at the moment. I've checked the price today, and on amazon.co.uk it is £2.75. And it's also, if you've got a Love Film subscription, it's available to rent on the Love Film site.
Interesting. It is available as a Region 1 DVD as well. It sells on Amazon.com for about $15 right now, I think, and about $8 as a download on Amazon Instant. It's a little more expensive at the moment on Amazon.ca in Canada, I think somewhere around $30. But it is available as a Region 1 disc and easy to get a hold of, which is great.
Or, if you want to watch it before our next episode, it does seem that at the moment all the episodes are available legitimately to watch on the PBS YouTube channel. And I'll put a link up in the comments section and on the Facebook page when we post this episode so that you can find the episodes there. And that does, as I say, seem to be legitimately available on YouTube at the moment.
Is that for US viewers only?
No, I was able to watch it here in the UK as well. So at the moment, it seems to be there.
Okay, that's great. So that's another option to take a look at it there. So I think that brings things to a nice close for the first half of our discussion about The Last Enemy. Next time, we will talk a little more about the story and its vision of the future of London and these sort of interesting sci-fi elements that are in there. And we'll try to bring together some of these plot strands, because there are lots of pieces of story going in different directions. You know, some interesting, complex stuff in there.
Yes, I think complex is putting it mildly. There are, as you say, several plot strands which we'll try and coordinate next time. And of course, we'll also do our reviews and recommendations about whether you should watch this show. Although, as we've said, it is fairly easy to get hold of if you want to catch an episode or two before our next show.
Absolutely. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We are on the Geek Culture Network. You can find us at thegeekculturenetwork.com as well. We also have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there.
Yes, and the Facebook group is quite busy at the moment, but you'll also now find us on the Voice of Geeks streaming radio network at vognetwork.com. And again, welcome to all listeners on the Vogue Network. And as of the time of recording this, we will have a British Invaders forum on the Vogue Network site. So if you don't like the Facebook thing, you can perhaps come and join us and make some comments and suggestions over there.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you for listening. And this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. And until next time, this is Eamon in England also signing off.